Merrick Garland speaks, Trump invades, and the media insinuates. We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Madeline Maddie Kearns, and the notorious M.B.D. Michael Brendan Doherty. You, of course, listening to a Nash View podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Babbel, Acton Unwind, more about them. In due course, if for some reason you're not already following us on streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. If you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So MBD, the week has been mostly consumed with a Mar-a-Lago search or raid, depending on your preferred term. But we had Merrick Garland in the Justice Department saying, you know, this is all by the book. We're not discussing this. You had various Justice Department reporters saying, you know what? The Justice Department is consumed by the example of James Comey, who felt compelled to explain why charges weren't going to be recommended over Hillary Clinton's email mess. Everyone knows that ended as a debacle. No one was happy with it at the end. It affected the presidential race in 2016. The IG sternly rebuked him after he left office. So Merrick Garland's not saying anything. And then lo and behold, yesterday afternoon, Merrick Garland feels compelled to say something because it's such a huge matter. And there's reporting from Newsweek. I'm not sure whether I believe everything in that Newsweek report. One thing they say is that Merrick Garland didn't approve this. Garland told us yesterday, no, yes, I did. But according to the Newsweek report, there was a thought that this might not be that big a deal if the FBI showed up when Trump was in Bedminster or New York and not there on premises. It wouldn't be such a big deal. If they thought that, obviously, they're complete idiots. This has been, you know, a DEFCON 3 or 4 type event, and Garland had to address it and wants now to release the warrant. What do you make of it?
Well, I don't know. Garland scored some points yesterday, but he also, you know, made himself vulnerable too. I mean, he kind of gave, you know, the typically Comey-esque smarmy defense of the Justice Department and its even-handedness and professionalism, which is just going to inspire yawns and eye rolls among the right. You know, given that we haven't seen this done to people who have, you know, we didn't see this done to Hillary Clinton. We didn't see it done to Sandy Berger when he went in and stuffed documents in his pants from the National Archives. And, you know, while people were looking through them for evidence about, you know, what led up to 9/11. So I don't think his defense of the Justice Department was very thorough or good. It was just newsworthy because he took responsibility. It's weird that he waited until Thursday to do this. I mean, he could have gone out on Monday and said just as much. But yeah, I don't think he really did himself any favors here. And we still don't know why now. I mean, that was one of the questions I walked away from that wondering is why, if this was known, why wasn't this done earlier? Why was the timing now, you know, 90 days before the midterms?
So, Charlie, we've also had some more media reporting. We had a big New York Times piece yesterday, a big Washington Post piece. The New York Times piece says that this was top secret level material that they were worried about related to programs, very sensitive national security programs. Then you had the Washington Post saying it was material related to nuclear programs. And just given, you know, what's happened in the last 5 years and how we know this stuff played out in the Russia hoax, you just have to read it with a lawyerly eye, assuming that their officials giving this information that do not necessarily have an interest and the public having a really clear-eyed view of what exactly it is and want it to make it sound as ominous as possible, when the construction that it's related to nuclear or nuclear program is massive. I mean, you can drive a truck through that. It could be, you know, a picture of an Iranian missile, or it could be just one reference to nuclear. You know, nuclear could show up in the on the page of some of these documents when the document has something to doesn't really have anything to do with nuclear at the end of the day at all. Or it could be the blueprint, you know, for a hypersonic missile, although I doubt that.
No, I think it's pretty clear now that Donald Trump is trying to build a bomb at Mar-a-Lago. But I obviously don't know any more than anyone else does, but you can count me on this one among the skeptics. Donald Trump should not have those documents. He is among a good number of people who have removed documents from their rightful place, and he should be treated in the same way as they were, whatever that means. But the sudden escalation to national security, to nuclear information, strikes me instinctively as exactly the sort of too clever by half linguistic games that we have seen the intelligence services play for 5 years now. I do not doubt that there is some plausible or defensible nexus between the words nuclear or national security and what is in those documents. I do doubt that the inference a normal person would draw from that is false. This is a cousin, I suspect, of weapons of mass destruction. It is the most dramatic gloss that can possibly be put on what Trump has and what the Department of Justice was looking for. One can imagine quite easily playing this game in other circumstances. For example, Hillary Clinton had her homebrew server and a relatively insecure email system set up. Within those emails, there were undoubtedly references to diplomatic talks, to American military assets, to strategic State Department business. If you use the right combination of words in the right order, you could make it seem as if floating around on the internet were some of America's most tightly kept secrets, but that wouldn't necessarily be true. So while reiterating that I don't know any more than anyone else, and that Trump shouldn't have these documents and should have handed them over if he had been asked, I am deeply skeptical that this is as serious as it has most likely been made to sound.
Yeah, so Maddie, Charlie's cautionary note there is appropriate. We don't know, and we need to learn more, but I think it is appropriate to be skeptical of the direst spin that's being put on this stuff. But it seems, at the very least, an element of this dispute very likely has to do with Trump's fondness for mementos. You talk to people who went to Trump Tower back in the day before, you know, 2015, and Trump just had all this cool stuff he'd, you know, gotten in his over the course of his career, you know, artifacts from various celebrities and whatnot. And he'd show everyone, you know, everyone who came in, look, I got this very cool thing. And there was, you know, characters long lasting, people don't change, especially when they're 70 years old. So this Trump, you know, in the Oval Office, would people would come in and he'd say, look, you won't believe this letter that Kim Jong-un sent me. And then ask some underling, go get the letter. And there was a box outside the Oval Office, and they bring in the letter, and Trump would show them the letter. This is a bragging point that you got letters from this monster, but Trump considered it one. And it seems pretty clear. I think there have been suggestions that those letters actually literally might be part of this dispute, or certainly things of that nature were part of this dispute. And you know, if that's all it is, I think a lot of people, even if Charlie's right and Trump just had no right to this stuff and shouldn't have taken it, people are going to think, well, this is wildly disproportionate that we've had this controversy now roiling the country and setting half the country ablaze over who really has true ownership of a note sent to Trump by some foreign leader.
Yeah. I mean, as you mentioned, it's difficult to know whether the argument set out in that Newsweek piece by those two sources, those two senior officials, was true, that they actually thought that this would be low key if they just showed up when he wasn't there. But I thought Andy McCarthy had a good post on the corner where he was talking about how Garland's response was very reactive, and it was he was clearly on the back foot. But one thing in his defense was that he was pivoting clearly towards transparency. And once this warrant to be made public, and it's interesting that Trump has been kind of coy about that. I mean, it's not really plausible that he doesn't have a copy of this warrant, because it's standard procedure that it would be left with him. So why hasn't he made that public? It sort of reminds me of, you know, the situation with Trump pleading the fifth, because transparency can sometimes cause more problems for him. So there's definitely that's a unknown for me, and I'm share Charlie's skepticism, but it will be interesting once that comes out.
So Charlie, another element of this that could be really interesting going forward is just what exactly is the appropriate process for declassification? You talked to the Trump people. Actually, let me mention first, I was watching Lawrence O'Donnell two nights ago, you know, 11 o'clock at night, and he had a legal panel, and it was that guy, Andrew Weissman, who is such a nasty piece of work and helped drive the Mueller investigation into really bad places. And then two professors, and one of them was, you know, it was all kind of walls closing in stuff. They finally got him now, was the tone of it, except this professor mentioned, you know what? It's never been litigated how exactly a president should and can declassify stuff. So he just noted, if this goes, you know, if they try to prosecute him over this, which I doubt they'd actually do, but if they do, you're going to instantly be in this totally unknown territory. And you talk to Trump people and the case they'll make, and I'm just curious what at least your impression, what your take would be as a matter of first impression, even if you haven't thought about this much, is that classification and declassification, it all emanates from the president. So you can't have someone in the executive branch coming up with a process that binds the president when it comes to classification and declassification. So if you're maintaining that, oh, you know, Trump said he just declassified these boxes, but actually it didn't get stamped the right way, or this bureaucrat didn't look at it and approve it, that none of that will stand up at the end of the day, because any authority they have comes from the president. So he sort of has this magic wand, and he waved it over all this stuff. So even if you think he shouldn't have it, he declassified it. And even if the process, every I wasn't dotted and every T wasn't crossed, that doesn't matter, because he's the president.
But Congress can superintend classification, I assume. I certainly agree that within the executive branch, the president has full authority. If he didn't, we would have a fourth branch of government. The way people talk about the Department of Justice and the FBI suggests that they believe they are a fourth branch of government. I have been bothered, for what it's worth, by the claim, whether it's true or not, that Joe Biden did not know this was going to happen, and that he didn't know Merrick Garland was going to speak yesterday, that he learned about it from the news media, a favorite claim of Barack Obama's. But Congress is preeminent. We don't have co-equal branches. We have Congress and then the others. And I think as a matter of priority, Congress ought to set out some rules. Congress ought to make it clear what it thinks the result of any litigation should be. And if the reason this hasn't been litigated is because the statute is ambiguous, then it ought to clarify it. Certainly, it is not the case that this hasn't been litigated because it never happens. The question of secret documents and classification does seem to keep coming up. So I would favor Congress stepping in and making its will known. I certainly think, though, that if it is the case that up until now, every president has been assumed to have carte blanche, and if it is the case that this has never been litigated, and if it is the case that the presumption, therefore, of the executive branch is that this power lies without a caveat with the president, it would be a problem to try to prosecute the president and skip over that step. And as such, I have some sympathy for any Trump world figures who make that case.
So, MBD, another element of the dispute here is, what were the steps prior to this escalation to go for the search? Because the Trump people will claim, well, look, we had this pleasant interaction. I think it was in June. The people came down. Trump was greeted them warmly, said, whatever you want, don't worry, we'll get it to you. Then they get the subpoena in, also in June, and then they hear nothing else, except for, I think, a request to see video, a security video of one of the rooms to make sure no one's coming in or coming out, which they apparently comply with, but nothing else. No sign that it's going all the way to a search of this nature. Whereas, you know, the Justice Department is saying, we made every effort to accommodate, and you know, we still have this blank space between June and now that hasn't been filled in. But their clear implication is that we did everything in our power, and it was only when it was clear to us that they weren't being forthcoming, you know, which is easy to believe. And if you believe the Newsweek story, again, I'd put an asterisk on that one. There was some sort of mole or informant who got in touch and said, this is where all the sensitive stuff is, you know, if you're going to come and get it, this is the time, and this is where it is.
Yeah, no, the process we need to know more about, and I'm surprised, like Maddie is, that Trump hasn't said more about it, right? I mean, he has complained that it's being unfair, that he's been treated unfairly, that you know, he swears now he understands why people plead the fifth, you know, things like that. But we haven't really gotten the full story on his end. So I imagine that, I mean, you know, when you take all the things together, it looks like there are some elements of this story that maybe Trump finds problematic or embarrassing in some way, or difficult to explain. Otherwise, he'd be out there shouting it from the rooftops. But also the kind of sleaziness about the way that the Department of Justice has gone about this, with like its press conference yesterday, and then you know, telling us how professional it is and how transparent it is, and then within minutes leaking to the Washington Post and CNN and other favorite outlets to get its story out there and sensationalize it again. I don't know. It just, it doesn't look like Trump is wholly innocent, and it doesn't look like the DOJ is fully on the up and up at all.
I suspect one reason he doesn't want to release the warrant is that releasing the warrant demonstrates that the government went through the requisite steps, and he is playing the victim, and it weakens his hand a little bit to say, look, here is a signed and notarized warrant. I'm not convinced that it's what's in it that he wishes to avoid. I think he probably doesn't want to talk about it.
So, next question to you first, MBD, if you had to force yourself into one of these categories at the moment, based on what we know now, with aware that there's more we need to learn, and this is inherently a speculative answer, do you think that it's likeliest that the documents down at Mar-a-Lago were so sensitive that the DOJ had no choice but to go down and get them? Or do you think there's a colorable case, there's at least a colorable case, that they had to go and get them? Or three, that even if there were such a colorable case, ultimately, Andy McCarthy theory, this is a pretext, they're after something else, they're after January 6th evidence, or there is no case whatsoever, and it's just a complete outrage.
I'm somewhere between the Andy McCarthy scenario, it's pretextual, and the there is no case for this. It's a complete outrage. Just because I have so little faith in the Justice Department and the FBI in particular, because this was initially framed as a National Archives question, but it was originally framed as a National Archives question, and then when Trump pushed back, it's suddenly about nuclear weapons, but in the vaguest way possible. I don't know. It just, all of the red flags are waving. So, yeah, my confidence is pretty low in DOJ.
Charlie Cook?
I wouldn't draw the distinction that you did. I think that if this was a pretext, then there is no justification.
It's an outrage. So categories 3 and 4 collapse.
Well, I don't know if it's an outrage because I don't know the details.
No, but you're saying even if it's a pretext, it's an outrage. You know what I mean?
Yes. But, you know, as you know, I think Al Capone was railroaded. So I don't like pretextual government action.
Right.
Al Capone was guilty of sin and was a murderer, but I don't like it when government can't find what it really wants, and so it uses something else. I see that as likely to hurt, you know, 1,000 people who aren't Al Capone, mm-hmm. rather than as a clever way of getting Al Capone. I don't know if it was an outrage. What I do know is that it seems unlikely, on the balance of things, that it was necessary at this stage in the proceedings for the FBI at the behest of the DOJ to execute a search warrant, which is a different question than has Trump done anything wrong? Is there a case here? Is the interest per se warranted?
Mm-hmm.
I think that from what we know, this was a step that exceeded the likely justification.
Yeah, so sorry, I'm going to preempt Maddie a little bit, and she can come in at the end here and be the deciding vote. But I'm where you are, Charlie. I think, roughly where you are. I'm going to put words in your mouth, but I think there's a colorable case. So they didn't make this up. They didn't make up the idea that there might be classified stuff there that was technically illegal. The judge, you know, wasn't signing off on something that he believed to be a fabrication. So I think there's very likely a colorable case there. It's just that prudentially, I just don't think, when we know more, I think it's very unlikely that what they did here is going to stand up in any reasonable person. There are not many left. You know, any reasonable person is going to conclude there's no reason to go here on this matter. But Maddie, we're all awaiting your answer.
Yeah. So I think was likeliest disproportionate intervention, and I find Andy McCarthy's theory of it being pretextual, potentially to do with January 6th and looking for something, quite convincing. So that's my answer.
All right. So with that, let's pause and hear from our first sponsor this episode, Babbel. For all of your summer travels, whether you're going abroad or staying domestic and want to immerse yourself in the culture, now is the perfect time to start Babbel. Babbel is the language learning app that sold more than 10 million subscriptions thanks to Babbel's addictively fun and easy bite-sized language lessons. There's still time to learn a new language before you reach your destination. With Babbel, you only need 10 minutes to complete a lesson, so you can start having real-life conversations in a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Other language learning apps use AI for the lesson plans, but Babbel's lessons were created by over 150 language experts. Their teaching method has been scientifically proven to be effective. With Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. Plus, Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent. There's so many ways to learn with Babbel. In addition to lessons, you can access podcasts, games, videos, stories, and even live classes. Plus, it comes with a 20-day money-back guarantee. Start your new language learning journey today with Babbel. Right now, save up to 60% off your subscription when you go to babbel.com/editors. That's babbel.com/editors. It's BABBEL.com, by the way. Again, that's 60% off your subscription. Babbel, language for life. Please check it out. So, Maddie, I know you're not, you don't consider yourself a huge political pundit. You're more substantive than that. But in the punditry we've been doing on this podcast last several months, has been, you know, maybe Trump's losing his grip a little bit. Look at what DeSantis is doing here and doing there. There's this controversy. There's, you know, this anti-CRT bill. There's this firing of this woke prosecutor. I guess, was it last week, MBD? Or when was it? You're like, DeSantis is on fire.
Yes.
Women all over the country, they want DeSantis. It's like Tom Jones. It's crazy. And Maddie, this just shows there's just Trump has this ability still to totally command the stage. It's I was, as someone who doesn't want him to win the nomination again, obviously is dismayed. It kind of made the woke prosecutor thing, which was a controversy for about 5 days. You know, DeSantis was being called a strongman and authoritarian by all the right people. It makes it seem like just a local government matter. You know, as I wrote in a column this week, it's like Hollywood, Florida versus Hollywood, California. Whereas Trump, you know, instantly can cleave the country in two. That's an exaggeration because a lot of people don't care one way or the other, or still in the middle with all these theories and counter theories that are incredibly intense. Everyone immediately dials it up to 11. And it just feels like 2017 again, where it's all about Trump, and everyone in the media, by the way, is just delighted because it drives interest and ratings and page views.
Yeah. And there's also a strategy as far as the Democrats are concerned with this, because making Trump the center of the political drama gets away from inflation. It gets away from all of Biden's problems. And so I think they are very keen to keep him in the news. It was so much easier when Biden's entire campaign rested on not being Trump than it is when they had to make some sort of affirmative case for Biden and Biden's policies. And we're even seeing that in the way that Democrats are investing, financially investing in pro-Trump candidates in the Republican primaries. I know Charlie's spoken about that before, and how you can't have it both ways. It can't be democracies endangered by this man and then also be glad from a point of political strategy. I also think they risk overplaying their hand there. I mean, we don't know whether Trump could be successful. He was successful the first time around. I mean, obviously he wasn't in 2020, but he's a wild card. And so I think it is a risky game. And for those of us who would just like to move on, especially those in the Republican Party and those in the conservative movement, it's just exhausting to be constantly having this guy pop back up.
Yeah. So Charlie, you took the counterintuitive take on this in a post the other day. You're like, this is so boring. I'm bored. It's the same thing over and over again. Why do we have to do it?
Yes. I don't think that this particular drama is per se boring. And I agree with you, Rich, that it has been a boon to Trump in some ways, because it's given him an active controversy to revolve around. One of the problems that he's had is that the various political fights in American life over the last couple of years have largely occurred outside of his remit, because he's not president anymore. He can sit at Mar-a-Lago and he can send out his press releases or his truths on Truth Social, but it's Glenn Youngkin who's running in Virginia, and it's Ron DeSantis who has to appoint state Supreme Court justice or fire a prosecutor or set education policy or determine COVID mitigation efforts and so on. Whereas now we have a national scandal, and Trump is involved in it, and that activates people's endorphins. And when that happens, Trump benefits. I'm bored by how shallow and predictable and familiar all of the resultant responses have been. I am bored because I could sit every time now that there is a piece of Trump news and plot everyone in our little world on a graph. And worse, because I know that the people who are on that graph are mostly sitting there making sure they are in the right place on the graph. We don't really talk about Donald Trump. We don't really talk about the issues that Donald Trump brought to the fore or made more popular or less popular or more controversial or less controversial. We talk about other people in relation to Donald Trump. And I'm afraid an awful lot of people, especially in journalism, love Trump because they can use him to advance not a theory about Donald Trump or about politics, but a theory about other people within the zone. They can make themselves look like the number one Trump fan. Everyone else is in the way. They can make themselves look like the number one Trump resistor, and no one else understands the threat. All nuance, all analysis, all discussion quickly becomes subsumed to that imperative. And worse, all conversations about things that aren't Trump are brought back to Trump so that you can't talk about, say, Larry Hogan or Kristi Noem or Ron DeSantis or Greg Abbott, people who are in positions of authority over a lot of people who may well be the future of the party. You can't talk about them without their relative position on Trump or what they say about Trump or how much they resemble or oppose Trump becoming the topic within a matter of seconds. And this incident, although it is, of course, important, and although I'm happy to talk about it, and although I'm not going to dismiss it because it is a real question, just reminded me how boring it is to have Trump at the center of national life at the expense of pretty much everything else. At some point in 2015, the United States gave up talking about politics, talking about consequences, talking about ideas, talking about legislative priorities, and started talking about Donald Trump. And what the last week has shown me is that at the slightest news relating to Donald Trump, we will do it all over again.
So, MBD, there's just this aspect of Trump. There was a right-wing troll on Twitter. I don't know his full name. I don't want to mess it up, but tweeted yesterday, the day before, Trump is no longer a person. Trump is not a person. He is just a symbol now. And that states it too strongly, but that is the way a lot of people feel about him. And if he can get involved in this Manichaean struggle between good and evil and the views of a lot of people, it doesn't make anything else matter. What can matter in comparison to that? Electability, you know, whether you have policies, what does any of that matter when you are the guy at the center of this massive violation of our norms and our civil liberties that indicates the republic might be slipping away, right? So that's why Trump can escalate and say things that are totally preposterous. You know, they might have planted stuff on me, on and on. And it's really hard for anyone to disagree, right? It's really hard for other candidates who don't want to agree, don't want to be all the way over with Trump, to establish any separation, because it becomes like an all or nothing dispute. And this is why, Trump wants to be the victim. He's played the victim throughout his entire adult life. Very often it's been a negotiating tactic. You know, you're treating me so unfairly, so you need to, cut the price of these steel beams you're selling me by 50%. You know, that often has been the tack. Also, a similar sort of negotiation with the media. You're treating me unfairly. Forbes, list of billionaires, you're treating me unfairly. I should be this much richer. And it's worked for him in the political sphere, because being treated unfairly, which usually comes off as whiny and weak, for him has made him a victim of the malign forces that everyone hates. And if you're a victim of those forces, that's a huge benefit for a lot of conservatives and Republicans at the moment.
I I disagree, actually. Well, I mean, I agree in part. But
you're allowed to disagree. You can disagree.
That's not the whole story. I mean, listen, Trump was a victim in New York real estate. I mean, he was negotiating concrete prices with the mafia. I'm dead serious. The mafia controlled huge parts of construction during Donald Trump's, you know, booming building phase in New York. And yeah, he was treated unfairly, like all developers were. You know, and maybe that's a salutary experience for dealing with the Department of Justice for him. Matt Continetti, our friend, wrote in the Boston Globe a week or two ago that it's all Trump. He, you know, populists don't go away. They either die or they're killed because they have just such a deep personal connection with their supporters that's almost unbreakable. And that's what you were invoking in your kind of introduction to me here in this segment. And I think that's all important, and that may be enough to get Trump a nomination again in the Republican Party. It's not sufficient for him to win the presidency, and it blurs out all the things that Trump did right as a politician in 2015 and 2016. It blurs out he had an issue set. Mm-hmm. It blurs out that he was positioned as a candidate that allowed you to express dissatisfaction with both parties and and governance over a generation. That's so much less so now that Republicans have in some ways reconciled with him, and that he's moved towards them, right? I mean, he's no longer the guy that can say, hey, we're going to take care of everyone on healthcare in this country. You know, he's the guy who passed Paul Ryan's tax cut.
So would you say that you make an excellent point? So would you say that that stuff is more important than being the center of
attention? I would say,
or it's hard to say.
I would say being the center of attention. And remember, one of the reasons he's the center of attention is because it's good for the media, and because the media thinks it's good for Democrats again. And one of the reasons they think that is that Donald Trump was the center of attention for 4 years plus, and then he lost, and he lost bigly. So he to become president again, I think he would have to do normal politician things too. He would have to have a compelling story of why he is the man to fix it this time. And I think it's much harder to tell it. I think he lacks the element of surprise he had in 2016, which is that, you know, a huge number of people just never accepted the idea that he could beat Hillary Clinton. And so a lot of Democrats, I'm sure, regret not turning out that day the way they turned out 4 years later for Joe Biden. I think we are obscuring, we are looking at the populist magic that he has and that he's a master of, and that's very powerful. But I do think voters, and even a lot of Republican primary voters, are going to be looking at other elements of the equation here, and having an issue set other than I'm being treated unfairly was really important to Trump. I mean, Trump was an issue candidate.
So, Charlie, where are you on this question? Because, you know, I think the issues were important, but there was also, and I thought this in real time, there was just such, in 2015 and 16, he'd be standing in the middle of the stage, bigger than anyone else, you know, tanner than anyone else, oranger hair than anyone else, and just kind of a dominant figure. He'd do this thing, shh, and people would shut up. You know, it's just, he was like the alpha dog. And this is the phrase that our colleague Phil Klein used in the aftermath of the raid. He's the alpha dog again. So how important is that? And how important is the issue mix in your view?
I think both were important. I think that Trump will find it more difficult this time because he will not be most likely running against a Republican Party with easy issue foils. I think we talked about this before on this podcast. I don't believe that Donald Trump has a freestanding ability to destroy other people. I do believe that he is charismatic and has something that resonates with people, albeit not me. I don't believe that he has a laser gun in his eyes that he can just point at anyone and remove them. I think that it mattered, as Michael says, that he was running against an orthodoxy that, while I was broadly comfortable with it, was increasingly unpopular among the base, and that was personified, especially in, say, Jeb Bush. I don't think that will happen if he's running against Ron DeSantis. In fact, he might have some vulnerabilities if he runs against DeSantis, both because DeSantis would, if he wanted to, be able to say, here are some things you did wrong, here are some things you didn't do that I would have done, but also because DeSantis has internalized the lessons that Donald Trump taught Republican politicians. But it is going to matter in a potential DeSantis-Trump matchup that Donald Trump has something about him, the X factor. So I think both matter. I do think that next time around, the inbuilt and at the time unperceived advantage on the issues will not be there in the same way.
So I think he did. We'll move on in a second. I think he did have lasers in his eyes in 16 to some extent. Christie tells a story. I think it was the Reagan Library debate. They're all lining up, standing around, milling around, waiting to go on stage. And you know, they knew each other for a long time, were kind of friendly. And Trump, according to Christie's account, if I remember it correctly, Trump's like, "Watch, I'm gonna f with that guy down at the end of the line with the toupee." He was referring to Rand Paul. I don't think Rand Paul wears a toupee, but apparently that's what Trump said. And you know, they laughed about it, and they got on stage, and sure enough, there was this huge throwdown between Trump and Rand Paul that diminished Rand Paul just like right out of the box. But so
yes, but Rand Paul is not Ron DeSantis. Rand Paul had a series of policy positions that Trump could exploit, and the only reason it worked was because Republican voters were dissatisfied with the options on offer, and they looked at Rand Paul and they looked at Trump and they thought, well, Trump is a better choice. But I'm saying that I'm not sure that dynamic will be there in the same way this time around.
Well, this is the a number of people made this argument. I think Josh Krasjar made this argument, or no, it was the guy Dylan, the guy with Washington Post op-ed, I think. You know, the parties change. So there's Trumpism without Trump now. But I think, I don't want to make too much of this incident that I might be misremembering, but I don't think the dispute had anything to do with policy. You know, once they were on the stage, it was just kind of this the personal, you know, insult type politics that Trump so excels at. But anyway, X, a question to you first. MBD, the search of Mar-a-Lago makes it more likely that Trump will be the Republican nominee, less likely, doesn't have an effect, and let's double barrel it, makes it more or less likely or doesn't have an effect on whether he'll win a general election and be the president of the United States again?
It has no effect whatsoever. It only reminded us of the true dynamics at play in Trump and what William F. Buckley called the apparatus.
Charlie Cook?
I think it marginally makes it more likely that Trump will be the nominee and more likely that Trump will be the president. But I don't think in and of itself it will be enough to overcome any of the key factors that will determine both.
Matty Kearns.
I don't think it has an effect. And I think that Trump's biggest challenge this time around is that he lost in 2020 and he is a loser in that sense.
You know.
Well, the thing is, he's managed to get around that, of course, with this narrative of the stolen election. And maybe that's persuasive to even the majority of Republicans, but it's not persuasive to the majority of the country. And I think it's very, very difficult to come back from that.
So I'm going to say it's more likely on both, maybe not hugely, but more likely. It's more likely that wins the nomination than obviously makes it more likely that he's going to be the elected president, because he needs to win the nomination first. Although just in sheer isolation in a general election, it probably hurts a little bit. I don't think it's a massive change, but it is something of a change. And people who don't want him to get the nomination just have to hope, you know, with the news cycle, this thing has faded out in a couple months and it's back to what was the status quo prior to this, which, you know, Trump was not in a disastrous situation at all, but clearly had been diminishing over time. With that, let's pause and hear from our second sponsor this episode, the Acton Unwind podcast. Inflation, spiking gas prices and supply chain disruptions, woke celebs and corporations, political cronies and big tech, polarization and a culture in crisis. We know it's hard to stay up to speed with everything that's happening in the world. That's where Acton Unwind comes in. Join experts from the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty every Monday as they dissect the latest headlines in an easy-to-unravel roundtable conversation. Chat about politics, religion, and culture through Acton Institute's unique perspective, connecting good intentions with sound economics to promote a free and virtuous society characterized by individual liberty and sustained by religious principles. To subscribe to Acton Unwind, visit acton.org/NR or just search Acton Unwind on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. That's acton.org/NR to subscribe. It's acton.org/NR to subscribe. Please check it out. So Maddie, you've been very, very patient sitting through these topics that are not necessarily your highest level of interest. So let's go to something that is. There are continuing indications and some really significant ones now that it's beginning to be conceded that the rush to radical gender transitions, treating people for gender dysphoria has been a huge mistake, and we need to tap on or slam the brakes. What's going on here?
Yeah, so there's been a number of developments in the United Kingdom. Last month, the NHS, Britain's National Health Service, closed down its only and major gender youth clinic. So this was a clinic that was seeing thousands of kids a year, where it used to see maybe 100 or so. And they shut it down after an independent review highlighted that it was unsafe. The results of that review were pretty damning. There'd already been a number of whistleblower reports from clinicians inside the clinic who had complained that this was experimental, this was safe, this was ideologically motivated. There was huge concerns about the lack of follow-up, the lack of transparency, the overlooking of blatant comorbidities, so children who'd been abused, children who'd whose parents were maybe homophobic, didn't like that they had an effeminate boy or a masculine girl, wanted to transition them, all these things that should have been flagged but weren't because of political correctness. And so the NHS decided, and the government decided, that it was to be closed down. So they closed that down. And now children with gender dysphoria will be treated at hospitals where mental health will be the focus, which is huge, which is what everyone has been saying this whole time. You need to focus on treating the patient, not just succumbing to this political ideology. These things are very complicated. The reason why children disassociate with their sex are numerous, and actually a much more common one now, of course, is peer and social contagion, as we're seeing throughout the United States. The other significant thing to happen off the back of this is that there's now this pending lawsuit, this class action lawsuit against this now closed clinic. I think about 100 families are expected to join this medical negligence lawsuit, which is, of course, what those of us who have been warning about this have been saying needs to happen the whole time. We need to have the victims come forward, and we need to be able to pursue litigation. Unfortunately, that's much more difficult in the United States, partly because we don't have the transparency and it's not as clear where this is happening and how this is happening, but also because there's statute of limitations. And so lawsuits, oftentimes people don't realize how much they've been harmed until years later. And so if you only have a statute of limitations of 2 years or something, that's very difficult. And then the third big change that's happened in the UK is the UK's Attorney General has clarified that the schools do not need to defer to preferred pronouns of their students. They don't need to honour the gender identity when deciding who uses what bathroom and that sort of thing. And all of this is great for people in the UK, And all of it is also a reminder of how the US is going in the complete opposite direction. So we have Biden's Title IX guidance, which got kind of lost because it came out the same week as Dobbs. But all of that is very much encouraging schools to do the opposite of what they're doing in the UK, saying, no, you should be deferring to gender identity and preferred pronouns. And of course, the medical experiment in the United States is seemingly at the moment unstoppable. There's just an ever-growing number of clinics. They're even more experimental, even more aggressive and giving these irreversible changes to patients at younger and younger ages than it was ever happening in the UK. But I like to think it's something of a gunshot around the world about how this will end up, because eventually there will be lawsuits in the US as well. And this is the path that they're going down.
So why the usual dynamic, anything having to do with social issues broadly defined, it's the Europe and the rest of the English-speaking world, you know, the UK, Canada, that is in the advance guard of crazy. And we look at them and say, oh my gosh, I can't believe what's happening. You know, that would never happen here. And then, you know, 5 years later, it's happened here. But it seems as though perhaps that dynamic is being reversed here. Why is the UK, how has it gotten the message that this was a really bad idea, whereas it hasn't been absorbed in the US here yet?
I think there's a few reasons. The first one's probably just that the UK doesn't really have culture wars in the same way. Largely because there isn't a conservative movement, certainly not a socially conservative movement. There isn't really a socially conservative presence in politics or media. There's the occasional Peter Hitchens or you know, prophet of doom. But for the most part, everyone's kind of on the same page about what policy should look like, social policy should look like. So in a way, that has not, in the same way that in the US, it's given progressive something to hide behind. Like, look, these are just the same as all those people trying to ban abortion. This is just the same as all those people trying to, you know, who aren't happy about gay marriage. Whereas in the UK, mostly everyone is pro-abortion. Mostly everyone's fine with all the other LGBT stuff. So there's less place to hide. But I think the second thing is that there's just more of a focus in, certainly in British psychiatry, of empiricism and evidence. It's been less susceptible in the past to these kind of crazes than has American psychiatry. It's interesting, my friend Paul McHugh, who's now in his late 80s, early 90s, but he studied in both the UK and the US, and he made this point that the UK is sort of superior when it comes to actually following evidence on these things. So that also helps. But then there's a couple of structural things as well, which is just that because of the size of the UK and because healthcare is centralized, we've had greater scrutiny. It's been easier to keep track of exactly how many kids are being seen, exactly how they're being treated. There's all sorts of red tape in medicine anyway. And so that's kind of put the brakes on it in a more natural sense.
So MBD, this has been one of your arguments for a long time, going back years, that what you'll really need to stop this is some big class action suit going after the people who pursued these radical irreversible forms of treatment that really harm people and many people come to regret.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how many years ago it was, 4 or 5 years ago I wrote that, and it had probably come up in a conversation with someone even before that. Yeah, I think lawsuits are the way, because ultimately the U.S. mechanism for putting the brakes on this would be malpractice insurance companies, right? You know, if they are the ones paying out 8-9 figure judgments in giant class action suits, they will then inform the hospitals like, hey, why don't you just not specialize in this anymore? Or they'll make running a gender clinic financially unviable, right? Because the rates will be just so high for malpractice insurance in that case. So I think that is the way to do it in the U.S. I'm a little afraid, you know, Maddie says this is a shot heard around the world. I'm a little afraid that the Tavistock Clinic is going to be used as like a scapegoat and like it'll eat all the institutional sin this time, but other clinics are going to rise in its place. I mean, the UK kind of said, like, well, we're going to close this over the next year, and then we're going to have a series of regional clinics, and the regional clinics will have more flexibility than Tavistock had. And, like, you know, remarkably, like, the health service in Ireland refers its the children of that country to Tavistock and said it will continue to do so until it closes and is replaced by something else. So I think this is, you know, it's a huge warning shot, but I think the victory is still pretty far off.
Troy Cook?
Well, one of the worst things about being a conservative is that sometimes we're right. Mm-hmm. And we only discover this when we've gone through whatever it was that we were warning about in the first place. And sometimes that's innocuous. And sometimes its harms are distributed. And sometimes it's just absolutely brutal. And you end up hearing horror stories from people who have either themselves been taken in or someone on their behalf has been taken in by a fad from which they will never recover. And this is a good example of it. And I expect to see more such cases of regret and recriminations in the future. I am of the view that we are slowly winning this argument. I think that the culture is shifting. And I think that other than the zeitgeist change, which is the result of ordinary people recognizing that they're being bullied into saying things they don't believe, the primary driver of that is a new crop of young people, mostly young people, who are taking to television and the newspapers and social media and telling their stories and telling people who might previously have been content to ignore this in the hope that they'll be left alone by the Alphabet Club, what their lives are like, what it's like for them to go to the toilet, what it's like for them to try to sleep, what their chest looks like, how many drugs they need to take just to stay alive. And I don't believe that this absurd anti-human fad can survive contact with those people. And I, although accept it will be a long road, see this Tavistock development as part of that.
Excellent question to you, Maddie. I've asked before, I'll ask it again. We have now definitely reached peak trans. Yes or no?
No, certainly not in the United States.
MBD.
I think we may be getting near the peak of the surgeries and hormone treatments. But the phenomenon is growing, and I think I've said before that, like, terms like non-binary or gender fluid, they're kind of like the Omicron variant of trans identity. They're more virulent, you know, but less deadly.
There was someone who I think that I of course didn't care enough to click, but I saw some Twitter conversation. Someone had become de-non-binaried, to some famous non-binary person decided she wasn't binary anymore, and that, you know, like, what does Wikipedia do in that case, you know? Charlie Cook.
I think we've reached the peak. I just think that the consequences of that shift will take a while to become apparent, but I think in terms of public sentiment, we have reached peak trans.
So I would have asked this before. I'm pretty sure I've been on the pessimistic side, and Maddie and MBD almost convinced me, but I think I'm over with Charlie now. I just think there something has changed. Doesn't mean there's not going to be a lot of insanity going forward, but these treatments are going to be unsustainable here in the United States because they're completely wrong and the evidence doesn't support them. And eventually that will win out. And I think it just what's happened in the UK is significant. So I'm going with Charlie. We'll have an evenly divided panel on this one, 2-2, but I'm also a yes. With that, let me do a quick NR Plus plug. NR Plus digital subscription at nationalreview.com. Your way around our very annoying metered paywall. Just please let me urge you, stop trying to defeat our metered paywall. You might be able to do it, but it's not really worth it. And it's not a worthy endeavor to try to cheat us out. Can you imagine? We're being treated unfairly. We're just like Donald Trump now. We're being treated unfairly by some of our readers who are going out of their way to defeat our metered paywall when they should just pay up. We'll give you all sorts of benefits. One, the paywall goes away, so you don't have to worry about different browsers and all that. If you log in, once you're signed up, you see 90% fewer ads. I know the ads are annoying. I apologize. Believe me, we wish we didn't have to have any ads. They're obnoxious, but it's a really important revenue source. But once you've signed up, we don't need to worry about that revenue source with you because we have another really important revenue source, which is your true and honest subscription fee. So the ads go away. It's like magic. You can also plug deeper into our community if you're interested in that. And I think you should be. There's a robust debate going on in the comment section any given moment. I was looking because I was replying to it. Phil Klein's Alpha Dog post that I mentioned earlier. I don't know. I had 800 comments yesterday. I was certainly in the hundreds and growing. So you can be part of that if you want to. Obviously, not everyone's into that. That's fine. You can ignore it if you want to as well. There's also a private Facebook group, a much more controlled conversation, but a really robust one. I think the most robust such Facebook forum that any other publication of our sort has. So anyway, there are all sorts of benefits to NR Plus. And at the end, just circling back to what I was saying, you know, a little bit tongue in cheek about you cheating us if you don't sign up. This is a really important way to support our journalism. And we think our journalism deserves support. It needs support. Otherwise, it's going to go away. So please, please, please sign up for NR Plus if you haven't already and join tens of thousands of your fellow National Review readers as an NR Plus member. So with that, let's hit a few other things before we go. Maddie Kearns, you are spending this week in August house-sitting for a friend.
Yeah. So I'm in New York City. I won't say exactly where, but it's just been really nice. It's my friend has a great library, so I'm making the most of that. And just nice having lots of space and being able to walk around the city. And of course, when you're a guest in somebody's house, you're always slightly scared you're going to break things. So there's that element of tension. But otherwise, it's very pleasant.
What are you doing in this house? Throwing balls around, or
well, you know, like if
I'm drunk every night.
No. If you're using like nice dishes or something, you're just more careful than Got you would it. Be in your own home. But no, I'm certainly not throwing parties or anything like that.
Sure, right. That's the public. That's a cover story, at least. Yeah. MBD, you've been listening to John Coltrane.
Yeah, I've been listening to the album Ascension this week a couple times, and it's just another masterpiece from that period of bebop running from the late 50s to mid 60s. So consider this one of the last great ones. Came out in 66, and if you like jazz, or if you think you might like jazz, this is actually a great one to kick off a deeper exploration.
And Charlie Cook, your household is enjoying the new season of Bluey.
Absolutely. This has been greatly looked forward to by my kids. And also by me. I don't know if everyone listening knows what Bluey is, but Bluey is on Disney Plus. It's a show about four Australian dogs, but they're anthropomorphized. Kids absolutely love it, but it is one of those rare shows that adults absolutely love too. And last night we watched two new episodes. One of them is called Chest. It's actually about chess. And the other one is called Magic. And I can safely say that the makers of Bluey have not lost their touch.
So I've been listening to this podcast I mentioned before. It's a history of Europe through its wars. And it's incredibly detailed. I think I'm on the 50th episode now, but each episode has a number of separate sort of chapters on it. So I may have listened to 200 of these things now, and we're on the 30 Years' War at the moment. And I have to say, the 30 Years' War is completely fascinating, but I just do not understand it. Someday I'll sit down and read a book about the 30 Years' War. This is not that day, but it's just you got the religious and ideological element. Then you just have the sheer geopolitical element. Then you have just the personal dynastic element, who's married to whom and who hates whom. Then you have, you know, the wars itself, which are horrible. I mean, obviously incredible suffering subjected, that Europe subjected to, especially Germany. But it's kind of this fascinating period where it's not modern warfare, but it's beginning to kind of be modern warfare. And I am looking at Wikipedia now, and, you know, these are the whole world is kind of, it's beginning to be the modern recognizable world, but it's not yet. So I'm looking at the list of belligerents. You know, it's the Kingdom of Bohemia, the Palatinate, Savoy, Transylvania, Denmark, Norway, the Heilbronn League, and on and on and on. And from the Peace of Westphalia, France annexes, I'm not going to say it right, forgive me if I really need to do my Babel lessons, the Kapol and Upper Alsace, and then Sweden obtains Wolin in Western Pomerania, and Brandenburg, Prussia obtains Eastern Pomerania. So anyway, it's incredibly significant and complex event, a fascinating one, but besides what I've said, and most of it's come from looking at Wikipedia, and even though I've listened to these podcasts, I can't tell you. I can't explain more. With that, it's time for our editor's picks, MBD. What's your pick?
My pick is a little post by Mark Wright, just titled, very provocatively, Yes, Her Emails, about Hillary Clinton. That is perfect little provocation.
Maddie Kearns.
My pick is Ryan Mills' Schools Are Wasting COVID Cash from the latest issue of the magazine. Ryan's a great reporter, and we're lucky to have him. And it's an articulation of one of those basic conservative objections to government spending, which is that so often it's wasted. So recommend that.
Charlie, what's your pick?
I hope one day I can stop saying this, because I am no longer being presented with the opportunity to do so. But my pick is Andy McCarthy's coverage of everything that has happened in the latest Trump saga.
I know.
Since Monday. I would love for us to be debating policy day in, day out, but we don't. We debate the FBI and the DOJ and warrants and pretextual searches, and Andy's exceptional at explaining it as a real resource.
So I was going to go on similar grounds with Charlie, with Dan McLaughlin's piece yesterday about how the FBI's explanations don't add up. And just to have Andy and Dan and a number of other people, including you, Charlie, on these legal political disputes is really invaluable. But instead, I was reminded of this Ryan Mills piece from earlier in the week, when Maddie picked a Ryan piece about crime in Colorado. And it's really in depth. It's really compelling. Colorado is not necessarily at the front of anyone's lips when we talk about the crime surge, but it's had a terrible crime surge. And it's the classic story that you've seen everywhere. You know, they've reduced the threshold for what is a serious auto theft and what the punishment is for auto theft, I believe. And it's just, of course, they've had a huge spike in people stealing cars. So there's a big dispute about why Colorado suffered this crime wave, and Ryan really nails down the reasons why in a terrific piece. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National Review magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes it sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Maddie. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to Babbel and Acton Unwind. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.